This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. And we begin today in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in the east of the country, which borders Rwanda. It's a mineral-rich region of the DRC and politically unsettled, and it's currently convulsed by an offensive by the M23 rebel group. Thousands have been displaced as the Rwandan-backed rebels pursue an offensive which has so far resulted in the capture of the eastern city of Goma. The rebels are now advancing south towards the city of Bukavu, but their progress has reportedly been slowed. Today, the UN spokesman, Stephane Dujarric, gave an assessment of the numbers of people killed and injured in the fighting in Goma.
The World Health Organization and its partners conducted an assessment with the government that's between the 26th and yesterday, and report that 700 people have been killed and 2,800 people injured that are receiving treatment in health facilities. These numbers are expected to rise as more information becomes available.
And a short while ago, we got through to BBC reporter Paul Njie, who's in Gisenyi on the Rwandan side of the border, crossing with the DRC.
So what's been happening today? We've seen people coming in from the DRC, moving into Rwanda through the Gisenyi border. And they've been coming basically with whatever they could find, whatever they could come up with. Some people came in with their clothes in loincloths, speaking about how dire the security situation is in Goma right now. We spoke to one woman this morning who told us that her husband was shot and he was killed as a result of the M23's offensive in Goma. She said she's not sure she's ever going to return if the M23 are not out of that area. So I guess it shows just how dire the security situation in the area has been. And of course, some say that relative calm has returned, and we saw other people trying to move into the DRC earlier today. So it's a bit a mixture of both. People coming in, those trying to go back, but those who have come in with harrowing stories.
And those civilians fleeing eastern Congo, fleeing Goma, are they doing so to escape the fighting or because they're being targeted?
Well, some people say they just decided to flee because they were uncertain about what the security situation would be like going forward. And the Congolese government, the president Felix Tshisekedi, said a couple of days ago that they were going to do everything possible to reconquer any territory they've lost. And of course, the M23 as well say that they are trying to advance and capture more territory. So the growing rhetoric in both camps are making people to be afraid. But then there are those who say that they've lost family members as a result of the fighting and so would not want to stay back to be victims of the war, which they already are, but they do not want to be victims in the sense like lose their lives. They've already lost families, property, and now their lives are the only thing they've got left.
That was BBC reporter Paul Njie speaking from Gisenyi on the Rwandan side of the border crossing with the DRC. And let's hear briefly now from the Congolese government. This is what the country's Foreign Affairs Minister, Therese Kayikwamba Wagner, told the BBC earlier today about her government's expectations from the international community.
I think, first of all, aid should be stopped to Kigali. Secondly, there need to be sanctions targeting the command structure of the Rwandan Defense Forces, as well as the politicians that have been enabling this warfare in the Great Lakes region and in particular in the DRC. Also, I think that Rwanda ought to be under an embargo for all of its mineral exportations. They should not be benefiting from what has been mined illegally and under forced labor in the eastern DRC. Rwanda should also be suspended, this is a very important point, suspended as a troop contributing country to United Nations peacekeeping missions. I want to remind you that in the past week, 17 peacekeepers were killed by the RDF and by the M23. Peacekeepers killed by Rwanda, which is one of the largest troop contributing country to United Nations peacekeeping missions. It is unacceptable. Rwanda is not a peacekeeping champion. Rwanda is a warmonger. We see it right now in eastern DRC.
That was DRC's Foreign Affairs Minister, Therese Kayikwamba-Wagner. Well, there's long been bad blood between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda following the genocide of the Rwandan Tutsis in 1994. Many of the Hutu perpetrators escaped across the border into the DRC, where they reconstituted as the FDLR militia. While the M23 are a Tutsi-dominated rebel group, which has been accused of widespread human rights abuses, including the shelling of civilians in this latest outbreak of violence. And this is not the first time they've gone on the offensive against the Congolese army and state, and not the first time that Rwanda has been accused of backing and fighting alongside them. So why is Rwanda doing this? Rwanda's foreign minister is Olivier Nduhundagaregi.
Rwanda is defending its territory. Rwanda is under threat by a coalition in Eastern DRC organized by President Tshisekedi, and that includes the FDLR genocidal force that committed genocide in Rwanda against the Tutsi in 1994, but also other forces like the local militias, Wazalendo, and the Burundian forces, the Sami DRC, which are from the SADC region, but also the European mercenaries. So we have this whole coalition that was deployed, but it was deployed in a context of regime change rhetoric, which is really regular and constant by President Tshisekedi, because he said on several occasions that he wants to overthrow the government of Rwanda and bomb Kigali without even setting foot on the ground. So we are defending our territory. We have put in place defending measures which will stay in place until this threat is removed.
So how many Rwandan troops are there in the DRC?
I told you that we have defensive measures at our border.
Right, but even defensive measures require the deployment of troops. And I was wondering how many Rwandan troops you have in the DRC.
You know that every defensive measure has troops, has other means to defend our territory. This is what we have deployed for the past 2 years to ensure that our people is protected.
So these Rwandan troops, you argue, remain on the border and have not taken part in any of these incursions by the M23 deeper into the DRC.
But the M23 is a Congolese movement defending a Congolese community, saying that the M23 has been deeper in the Congo. They are on their territory. So they have a specific issue about their community that is persecuted, that was marginalized, discriminated against, and then victim of hate speech. You know that in October 2023, the Congolese government, together with the FDLR and other militias, they burned down 300 homes of Congolese Tutsi in a village called Nturo in Masisi. And then this is what we are facing now in Eastern DRC. This is what the M23 is fighting for.
Fighting for what?
To defend their population, their community that is marginalized for decades, that is victim now of hate speech, while actually the world, the international community, is keeping silent, and not even silent, just accusing Rwanda instead of looking at the situation that is going on in Eastern DRC, which is genocide ideology, ethnic cleansing against community, the Congolese Tutsi.
And the Rwandan government supports the M23 in this particular campaign.
We have a common goal for sure, because when we are facing a genocidal movement, that should be an enemy of anyone and everybody. I don't even understand why the international community would accommodate or would accept that a genocidal force remains on a territory in Eastern DRC for 30 long years, threatening a country that suffered a genocide from that particular movement.
So just to explain, this particular dispute goes all the way back to the genocide in Rwanda and the flight of Hutus who were held responsible for that genocide into the DRC. And you are saying that those Hutus, the Hutu militias, are now terrorizing the Tutsi population of Eastern Congo, and they need to be protected.
This is not what I said. This is what happened. I just gave you a specific example. So they fled Rwanda in 1994. They continued in Eastern DRC with their genocide ideology. They also recruited the new elements, and now they are still persecuting that community, and they are even now more powerful because they are embedded in the army, Congolese army, and they are supported by President Tshisekedi. So this is what we are facing now.
I mean, you ascribe these very noble aims to the M23, and yet a UN report in December last year said that the M23's decision, for instance, to capture the mining town of Rubaya, which fell to its forces in May, was motivated by a strategic need to monopolize the lucrative trade in coltan used to make batteries for electric vehicles and mobile phones. So there's a commercial imperative here, and I would argue that that commercial imperative is shared by Rwanda.
That is the narrative that we know from Kinshasa, which was endorsed by part of the international
community. I've just quoted a UN report, not a claim by the Kinshasa government.
Exactly. This is what I say. I say that it's a narrative from Kinshasa that was endorsed by part of the international community. This is what I say. This region is the land of those people. It's their ancestral land. It's on their land that they are, that they defend. They were actually being chased from their land. We have more than 100,000 refugees from that community in Rwanda because they were chased by the Congolese government and the militias from their land. The fact that there are minerals on their land, that is another matter. It's not their objective. As a matter of fact, Rwanda has also minerals, as we know. We are on the same rock as the DRC, because I don't believe that minerals can magically stop on a colonial border.
Okay,
because those borders were drawn by the colonial powers.
Okay, but Rwanda exports more minerals than it produces, which leaves open the question of where those additional minerals are coming from, and many say that's from the eastern Congo.
We have plenty of minerals. That is one. And second, Rwanda is a stable country with a business environment, a good climate for business. So the fact that some of the traders go through Rwanda because it's where they can do business, it doesn't mean that it's about plundering Congolese minerals. That was really been a lazy argument to avoid to talk about the security concerns of Rwanda. But maybe the international community and the DRC government should call our bluff. If we are saying that we have security concerns, they should address them.
That was Rwanda's Foreign Minister, Olivier Nduhungirehe. Coming up, we hear how India has managed to increase the number of tigers, despite being one of the most crowded countries in the world.
The culture and religion of Indians has been quite tolerant traditionally towards all life forms, including large carnivores. There are huge conflicts with carnivores. We lose about 35 people annually to tiger predation. But now buffer zone areas around tiger reserves get benefits from the gate receipts of tiger reserves. Incentivized voluntary relocation gives a good package of about $22,000 per adult in the family.
And that interview in full coming up in about half an hour. The top story from the BBC newsroom: the UN says fighting between Congolese forces and Rwandan-backed rebels for the city of Goma has killed at least 700 people. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The German parliament, the Bundestag, has narrowly rejected legislation to tighten immigration policies after a heated debate. The legislation had been proposed by the main opposition conservatives of Friedrich Merz, tipped to be the next chancellor. But it would have relied on support from others to pass, including the far-right Alternative for Germany. That saw several left-wing parties accuse Mr. Merz of breaking a long-standing taboo in post-war German politics regarding the far-right. I've been speaking to the BBC's Damian McGuinness in Berlin, and he told me first about the scenes in the German parliament today.
There were times in the past, Julian, when the German parliament was known to be a sort of staid, polite, very calm place, very different to other countries. Those days are gone. What we've been seeing recently, but particularly today and this week, incredibly ferocious debates, frayed tempers, high emotions, insults being thrown round, jeering, shouting. You know, this is not how German politics used to be. And I think this is really a reflection of how polarized the political system has become here, and particularly over migration. And that's what this bill was all about. And of course, the big problem here was that the Conservative Party was trying to pass a bill in Parliament, knowing that the far-right AfD would support that bill. So on the one hand, you had the usual ferocious debate around migration itself, and added to that, this huge taboo in German politics about working with the far-right AfD, because that essentially, in modern German political culture, that's just a no-go. It's seen as undermining German democracy, and working with the AfD means either forming a coalition with them, but it also means having their support to push a bill through Parliament.
And how tight was the vote when it came?
Well, it wasn't really clear how it would pan out, actually, because looking at the numbers, the parties had said they'd vote for it, the Conservatives, the far-right AfD, a new populist left-wing nativist party, the BSW, they all said they would vote for it. But if everyone had voted for it, it would have passed. So what we know is that some of those in the Conservative Party decided that they did not agree with their leader's line. I think it's about a dozen Conservative MPs are thought to have rebelled. And that's not surprising, because a lot of people had deep misgivings, not only because of the support of the far-right AfD, but also the contents of the bill. Friedrich Merz is going very hard line on migration, including in this bill, but also in other motions this week, and some very drastic measures, including proposing to close all borders to all asylum seekers, including unprecedented amounts of powers to the police to arrest migrants. Some things that a lot of moderate conservatives are very uncomfortable with. And even some very high-profile figures within the Conservative Party saying they think Friedrich Merz is wrong. Most high-profile was, of course, the former Chancellor Angela Merkel, who used to lead the Conservative Party. She made a very unusual intervention yesterday, saying that she believed Mr. Merz was acting wrong to do this. Very unusual for a Chancellor to do something like this. So I think what we've seen is this snowball effect, that some support within the moderate wing of his Conservative Party has ebbed away, and that's what's happened.
So where does it leave Mr. Merz's leadership and indeed the Conservatives in the forthcoming elections?
This is a blow to him to lose this vote, but he is seen as a strong leader within most of those within his party. He's managed to unify the party, and the poll numbers are still relatively strong. So his party is leading in the polls at around 30%. But that's not really enough to command a strong governing coalition majority. And really, given how unpopular the outgoing government is and how divided that government was, his poll numbers should actually be higher. As things stand, though, Julian, he looks set to be Germany's next chancellor. You know, this is a very fluid situation in Germany right now.
That was the BBC's Damian McGuinness speaking from Berlin. The Trump administration has said it'll go ahead with tariffs against America's three biggest trade partners from Saturday. It includes 10% on Chinese imports and 25% on Mexican and Canadians. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had previously said his country will respond forcefully. Mr. Trump says he wants stronger action to halt the flow of illegal immigrants and the deadly opioid fentanyl into the United States. Canada sends 75%, least of all its goods and services, to the United States, and the economy would be badly hit by Mr. Trump's threatened tariffs. Doug Ford of the opposition Conservatives is Premier of the border province of Ontario. Is he concerned about these tariffs against Canada?
I'm concerned for Canadians. I'm concerned for Americans. You know, our goal is to have the two greatest countries in the world, making it the richest and the wealthiest and the safest and most prosperous two countries in the world. That's what I'm concerned about. These tariffs will hurt American jobs and it will hurt Canadian jobs.
Your Prime Minister has said his country will respond immediately and forcefully. Do you go along with that?
Absolutely, I do. We want to make sure we match dollar for dollar, tariff for tariff, and they need to feel the pain, like all Canadians will feel the pain.
So what do you have in mind in terms of retaliation for these tariffs?
Well, Julius, we're going to have to find out what is coming at us, and we'll match them sector for sector, dollar for dollar. And unfortunately, we didn't call for this fight, but we'll stand up for Canadian jobs and livelihoods.
I mean, it's going to be a tit for tat, which is going to be injurious to the Canadian economy, if not the American.
Yes, it will. And it's very, very unfortunate. I want to do the opposite. I want to send them more critical minerals. I want to send them more energy, more electricity. That's what I want to do. Unfortunately, I don't believe President Trump wants that. We're their number one trading partner in the entire world. We do approximately $1.3 trillion of two-way trade. We're the number one customer for 28 states. And we're going to make sure that we keep moving forward and work collaboratively. I've talked to endless senators and governors and congresspeople, Republican and Democrat. Not one of them has told me they agree with economically attacking Canada.
Why do you think Mr. Trump is doing this? He's given the reasons that he wants to stop the flow of fentanyl and indeed immigrants into the United States. Do you buy that?
Well, what I want to do is I want to make sure both sides of the border are secure. I want to make sure that not one ounce of fentanyl comes in through our country. Now, let me just put this into perspective. When you look at the fentanyl compared to Mexico, which he's comparing us to, there's 19 kilos of fentanyl compared to 9,600 kilos coming from Mexico. 19 kilos in Canada represents 0.001, in my opinion. That's 0.001 too much. But what comes in through the American border is a lot worse. You know, you look at the stats there. We had over 3,959 kilos of cocaine, an increase of 168% in 2023, 37 kilos of heroin, and 21,457 kilos of other drugs and narcotics and precursors. And not to mention 95% of the guns that these criminals commit heinous crimes in Canada come from the United States. So, you know, I want to tighten up the border on both sides. We're doing that, and we need them to do the same. We're working collaboratively with the Drug Enforcement Agency in the U.S., U.S. Border Patrol, CBSA, which is the Canadian Border Patrol, RCMP, provincial police. So we're putting the resources there to secure our border.
Doug Ford, Premier of Ontario. And since we recorded that interview, President Trump has said he will decrease threatened tariffs on Canadian oil to 10% from mid-February. You're with NewsHour. Why does scratching an itch feel so good? We're always told that scratching a bite or a rash can be bad, but a study published in the journal Science has found that the reason it feels good is that it has a benefit. So what is that? I asked skin immunologist Dan Kaplan, who led the study.
If you think about what itch is, it's our body's response to some kind of insult on the skin, either a bug bite or some kind of chemical on the skin, and then the response is scratching, and usually we scratch until it starts to hurt. The interesting thing that we found is that it is actually the act of scratching and the activation of neurons that sense pain that leads to an increased inflammation in the skin. And the detriment of that is it makes your rash worse. Your mosquito bite that you scratch is significantly worse and lasts much longer than if you are able to resist this temptation to scratch that bite. However, it also causes increased resistance to bacteria on the skin. So the scratching can actually help reduce bacteria on the skin and presumably reduce the risk of infection.
Itching feels good, it would appear, because it's an evolutionary response.
Absolutely. I think it's a behavior that is reinforced. So if there's a behavior that's reinforced, there should be some good reason why it's reinforced and why it has persisted through evolution.
So if a child is scratching an itch, we shouldn't tell that child not to do it, or indeed an adult.
I don't think that's really good advice, because there's a big distinction between acute itch and chronic itch. So if you do scratch, there may be some benefit to reduced bacteria. But ultimately, what you do is you make the rash or the mosquito bite significantly worse. And if you continue to scratch a lesion, you will actually cause destruction to the skin. And that may ultimately cause an even higher risk of infection. So I think there is a benefit to scratching in the short term, but long-term scratching is certainly quite detrimental.
I mean, we've been speaking about mosquito bites, but what about, say, dermatitis?
Of course. So dermatitis, also known as eczema, one of the major symptoms is itch, and it's actually quite a problem. Most people who have dermatitis find that when they scratch it, it'll feel good, but it will ultimately make the itch and the rash itself significantly worse. And so in those cases, scratching is one of the worst things you can do to your dermatitis. It actually significantly can make it worse.
So in brief, if you're bitten by a mosquito, have a little bit of a scratch, but don't overdo it.
That sounds like prudent advice.
That was Dan Kaplan, Professor of the Department of Dermatology and Immunology at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. And we return to the Democratic Republic of Congo in advances by Rwandan-backed rebels in the east of the country. And the upsurge in violence there and the threat it poses to regional security has led to a flurry of diplomatic activity in Africa, Europe and the United Nations. African leaders and ministers have been meeting in Zimbabwe, while France wants Rwanda named as the backer of the rebels in a UN Security Council resolution. France's foreign minister has also been shuttling between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. I've been speaking to France's UN ambassador, Nicolas de Riviere, and put it to him that with the Rwandan-backed rebels continuing to make advances, maybe the time for diplomacy is over.
No, the time of diplomacy is not over. I think for the time being, we are just in the middle of a crisis. Rwanda plus the M23 or the other way around continues to believe that they will resolve the situation through military action. And we don't think this is the right answer to this crisis. So we will continue to push. Here in New York, you know, the UN and the Security Council are strongly urging Rwanda and it's basically its Congolese proxy, which is M23, to stop. And we will continue to push for that.
Because Congo's foreign minister has been speaking to us and she has come up with a list that she says would stop Rwanda from this offensive inside Congolese territory. Aid, she says, should be stopped to Kigali. There should be targeted sanctions and Rwanda should be suspended as a troop contributor to the United Nations. And she says that in particular because these Rwandan-backed M23 rebels have actually killed UN peacekeepers in the DRC.
Well, the foreign minister of the DRC came to New York last weekend. She was there until the beginning of the week. And I think you're right. This is the thing she said. I think she had good arguments to put that. Now, you know, the reality, the Security Council, you know, it's a decision-making process. You mean to have, you know, a majority of 9, the absence of a veto of a permanent member. So you need to have a full support of the Security Council to do this kind of things. So at this stage, what is pretty encouraging that there is large support in the Security Council to condemn the offensive by Rwanda and the M23, which is, as you said, you know, supported directly by Rwanda. I think there is no mystery. And to increase the pressure on Rwanda to stop. I don't think we have reached the point where there would be a consensus in the Security Council to put sanctions on Rwanda. So I'm not sure we are there. But what is very important is to push in this direction. And I think this is what France intends to do. We will propose today a draft Security Council resolution to move in this direction.
Aid, though, doesn't need, or rather the cutting off of aid to a country doesn't need the agreement of the UN Security Council, does it? France could do that tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think this is something, there could be also bilateral measures. I saw that yesterday the UK said they would consider such action. I don't think it has been announced or confirmed, but the UK said they would consider. So I think you're right. I think we can bilaterally take a number of steps. But again, we are not there yet.
What are you waiting for if we're not there yet? Are you waiting for the rebels to overrun Kinshasa?
No, I don't think the rebels will be in Kinshasa in the coming days. So we want to convince and to push the two sides to get back to the negotiating table. This is what they agreed to do last year. You know, under the so-called Luanda process, Rwanda committed to pull out of the DRC, and the DRC agreed to dismantle this rebel group called FDLR, who are just, you know, close to genociders. And we need to get back to that, because Rwanda has also legitimate security concerns, but these security concerns do not justify a blatant violation of the UN Charter and of the territorial integrity of their neighbor.
Why this apparent reluctance by France, the UK, the United States, in fact, many Western governments, to impose sanctions, to get tough with Rwanda's President Kagame? I see parallels, a lot of people see parallels here with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And the reaction of Western governments seems to be very different if one African country invades another.
Well, of course, there are similarities. I think you're right. You have one country who should not be present in another country, and this country should respect the basic principle of territorial integrity, borders, respect of the UN Charter. I'm not sure the two situations are exactly the same. When Russia invaded Ukraine, they said it was full of Nazis threatening Russia, which, of course, was just a lie, frankly, a blatant lie. In this case, I think there have been, in the last years and decades, legitimate security concerns by Rwanda in the Eastern DRC. That's a fact. And addressed.
Such as what? What are those security concerns?
The presence of FDLR and groups linked to the genocide.
Okay, so we're talking about Hutu Interahamwe, who fled Rwanda after the genocide.
Yeah,
some say with the help of France.
What I will tell you is that there is this security concern by Rwanda which needs to be addressed. And what I just told you 2 minutes ago is that the Luanda process was precisely there to address this very concerned by Rwanda, which is a dismantling of the FDLR. France has been doing that, and we have been urging and increasing the pressure on the DRC to tackle this threat and to dismantle the FDLR. So we need to get back to that. But again, this issue should be addressed according to the plan and not by an invasion of the DRC by Rwanda.
I mean, could it be that maybe France is too beholden to Rwanda? Rwandan troops are helping to guard French oil exploration in northern Mozambique. They've also been deployed in the CAR as a counterbalance to Russian forces. Is that maybe one of the reasons that France is holding back?
Absolutely not. I think we are dealing with a situation in the Eastern DRC on its own merits. We don't put everything in the same bag.
That was France's UN ambassador, Nicolas de Rivière. And we go now to Ukraine, and 3 years of full-scale war and the occupation of a huge chunk of territory has left more than 60,000 people missing. Some are soldiers missing in action, but many others are civilians detained by Russian forces and disappeared. And whilst Ukraine sometimes gets its prisoners of war back swapped with Russia, the civilians are very rarely returned. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, has been to meet one woman desperate to know what happened to her parents after the Russians took over her town.
Every morning they were apart. Tatiana sent a video message to her only child. It was a daily check-in. Because she and her husband were living under Russian occupation in southeastern Ukraine. And their daughter was worried. Ludmilla shows me a phone full of those messages and of memories. One is her dad's 50th birthday in life before the Russians invaded. In all the images, Tatiana and Oleg are full of laughter and life. But in September 2023, they were detained by Russian soldiers and disappeared. Ludmilla's grand saw it all as armed men dressed in black burst into their home and took Tatiana and Oleg away in handcuffs. For 4 months, there was no trace of them. Then one day, Tatiana was abandoned at a hospital in a coma. She never regained consciousness.
It's just so tough to think what they did to her. And why? My mom was 51. She loved life. Then everything was cut short.
Ludmilla's father has still not been found.
If, God forbid, something happens to my dad, it will kill me.
When the Russian army first rolled into Melitopol, Ludmilla joined the protests. Crowds sang their defiance then, waving Ukrainian flags in front of tanks and telling the troops to go home. Then the Russians began rounding them up. Ludmilla fled, but her parents stayed.
I'd say, Mom, maybe you should leave. And she'd say, just a little more time.
Tatiana was convinced that Ukrainian troops would retake their city soon and liberate them.
Some people die on the battlefield and others die in occupation, helping Ukraine in other ways. To me, she's a warrior. She knew the risks, but she had to help.
Ludmilla now knows her mother was charged with espionage, but only after she was dumped at hospital, unconscious. No one will say where she was held before that or what happened to her. And her father is officially missing, although he was taken by Russian troops. This is not an isolated case. In Kyiv, the Red Cross runs a helpline, and most people calling have missing relatives too, soldiers and civilians. The staff take details and fill in a database, but a tracing system can only work with information. And although international law says both sides in a war have to inform about all detainees, Russia just doesn't do that. Sometimes the missing do turn up. This is Anna, whose son Leonid also went missing in Melitopol. And after 3 months, he too was left at a hospital, extremely thin and dehydrated. His mother managed to speak to him then, and Leonid told her he'd been in hell. Leonid then disappeared again. He just turned up a whole year later, alive, but on trial in Russia for espionage. From stories like this, Ludmilla suspects her mother too was tortured. It's a thought almost too painful for her to take. But Leonid's story is also a reason for hope that somehow, somewhere, Ludmilla's father is also in a Russian basement or a prison cell, still waiting to be found. I couldn't save my mum, she tells me. And that is so hard. But I still have my dad, and I need to save him.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford reporting there on Ukraine's missing civilians. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. When used as directed by your doctor, opioid medicines safely help control severe pain. But there are risks when the medicines aren't used correctly because they are addictive. And in the United States, tens of thousands of people die each year from opioid abuse. In fact, it was declared a national health emergency by President Trump back in 2017. So it must be good news that a new type of non-opioid painkiller could soon become available for prescription in the United States. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a drug called suzetrigine, known by its brand name, Journavx, which offers relief from pain without the addictive potential of opioids. The drug has been reviewed for its effectiveness by the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. Dr. David Rind is the Institute's chief medical officer.
This is a medication that's intended to work peripherally, not inside the brain and the central nervous system, and interfere with nerve impulses. It blocks an ion channel similarly to how local anesthetics like lidocaine that you might get at the dentist works.
So it blocks pain rather than asking the brain to respond to it.
It blocks the nerve signals, though unlike a local anesthetic, this is a pill you take orally. And the hope is that it will decrease pain signals back to the brain. We've had other medications that also work peripherally, and they often are not quite as effective as the centrally acting ones.
And you have concluded that this is effective, but for what level of pain?
So it was researched for moderate to severe pain, and it does seem to have some effectiveness there. It's hard to know exactly how its effectiveness compares to drugs that we're all used to, like the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen and naproxen. And it's probably not as effective as higher doses of opioids.
But crucially, I suppose, it's non-addictive.
The belief is that it's non-addictive, and there doesn't seem to be any reason to expect it to be addictive. That said, we've spoken with some experts who continue to worry that until it's studied more, we can't know that for sure.
But it has now been approved. Is this new drug going to be expensive? And is it likely that people will prefer to use it rather than an opioid?
So a one-week course of this drug in the U.S. is about $220, and giving an opioid for a week is probably $4 or $5. So it's dramatically more expensive than opioids. But over the long run, if it does prevent opioid use disorder in people who have taken a week course of opioids, it would save money for the healthcare system. But individuals having to pay that much, if they didn't have insurance coverage of it, it's a lot more money.
And of course, doctors have to be persuaded to prescribe this drug rather than, say, an opioid?
Yes, and I think also rather than, say, an anti-inflammatory drug. And I expect that the first patients to get this medication will be those for whom there are particular concerns about using those other classes of medications. With opioids, people who are felt to be at increased risk for developing opioid use disorder, with the anti-inflammatory drugs, increased risk of gastrointestinal bleeding and things like that.
There is the prospect, if this drug is rolled out, of reducing the number of deaths in the United States from opioid abuse.
Yes, I mean, we're not sure how often a brief course of opioids leads to opioid addiction. But the thought is that it might be as high as 1% of people who get a short course could get this. And even at much lower percentages, this medication might make sense to use to try to prevent that kind of addiction.
That was Dr. David Rind, Chief Medical Officer of the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review in the United States. Some good news for tigers now, because a new study has found that the number of tigers in India has doubled in just over a decade. There are now 3,600. That's three quarters of all the world's tigers. And crucially, They're doing well with less habitat compared to other countries and living in the most popular, most densely populated country on Earth. NewsHour's James Menendez has been speaking to Yadvendra Devjala. What explains this increase?
Mostly tigers were limited by poaching, so poaching was controlled in India. Secondly, policies have been changed, so prey restoration has happened. Creating space for tigers by voluntary incentivized relocation of people from protected areas. And this has been the crux of tiger conservation, because you need space for biodiversity. And if there are people everywhere, then biodiversity cannot survive, especially not apex carnivores.
And do you think in that time, people's attitudes towards tigers have changed?
The culture and religion of Indians has been quite tolerant traditionally towards all life forms, including large carnivores. There are huge conflicts with carnivores. We lose about 35 people annually to tiger predation. But now buffer zone areas around tiger reserves get benefits from the gate receipts of tiger reserves. Incentivized voluntary relocation gives a good package of about $22,000 per adult in the family. And there is a lot of tourism potential for tigers through employment in hotels and that kind of stuff. And most livestock predation is compensated by the government.
And where the tigers aren't necessarily in strictly protected areas, have they adapted to live alongside humans, do you think?
So tigers minimize their overlap with humans, you know, and about 40% of our tigers share space with about 60 million people. But that is only possible if lands are spared as protected areas.
One interesting aspect of the study is that you found that they did do better in more prosperous parts of India rather than poorer parts of India. Is that right?
Absolutely right. So when the economy is low, people depend on forest resources and especially bushmeat consumption that depletes prey populations. And as soon as prosperity comes in, then livelihoods change to other forms of livelihood, which are conducive to recovery of biodiversity and tigers.
It's still quite a small population. Is the gene pool big and healthy enough, do you think, looking ahead to the future?
The tigers of India are the most diverse tigers, according to genomic studies. Of course, there are restrictions when there is no gene flow between isolated populations due to human reasons. But currently, we don't have any genetic problems in any single population. And animals are moving across human-dominated landscapes to exchange genetic material between different populations. Because we have connecting corridors of habitats, which are maintained sacrosanct, and any developmental activity which happens there happens with mitigation measures so that there is animal passageways which can cross them. You know, by protecting the tiger, you're actually protecting the ecosystem services and ecological security for future generations on the planet.
That was Dr. Yadvendra Devjala, ending this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.